Welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky and disturbing children's books, films and TV. I'm Adam Wybray. My co-host is Ren Wednesday. And today we're discussing two books by Susan Gates, Revenge of the Toffee Monster and Killer Mushrooms Ate My Gran. A full transcript of the show is available. So please check the show notes for that. Enjoy!
Good evening. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Adam.
Hi.
And hello, Willow, our returning guest.
Hi.
Who was last on quite a while ago now to talk about The Box of Delights, and is now here to dredge up another artifact of our shared childhoods, which is a couple of books by the English author Susan Gates. Who's another one of those very prolific children's books writers who have written over 100 books.
Really? What?
These must
be early in her career, because my copy of Revenge of the Toffee Monster only mentions sea hags, suckers and cobra sharks. So I thought, oh, this must have been a bit of a flash in the pan.
Oh, right. This is her early work. So yeah, we've got two of these 100 books, Revenge of the Toffee Monster from 1999 and Killer Mushrooms Ate My Gran from 2000.
I feel like they're sort of classics of children's libraries in primary schools. I could very distinctly recognise their covers from the shelves when I look at them, and sort of takes me back to being intrigued by the textures.
Published just at the right time for someone born in, say, 1991 to have read as a kid. So and you did, Willow. You definitely had Revenge of the Toffee Monster.
Yes, I did. I think probably a bit displeased when I first bought it to discover that the gorgeous colour picture on the front was not replicated within, and it was in fact only words that I had to read using my brain to trick me. But I do remember reading it nonetheless.
Yeah, and I also picked it off your shelf and read it, and only had this memory just of textures and sort of an unsettling atmosphere. So I thought it would be a good candidate for the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and of course, in contrast, you were a most prolific reader, so keeping you away from my books would probably have been quite tricky.
Yeah.
It says in the little autobiographical section, front page, just inside, it says that, I mean, she was a prolific reader. It says she read every science fiction book in Cleethorpes' public library.
Wow.
And also had a craze for all kinds of American literature, especially detective stories, which makes sense. I do think these have a hard-boiled edge to them. They're interesting stylistically, because she was born in Grimsby, and they do have a bit of a feel of Grimsby about them, and yet, like, they do also have that hard-boiled American kind of parody of almost like a detective story. Not like the plotting, just how it's written somehow.
I mean, it's very liberal on the similes. It's mostly what I noticed about the writing.
There's so many. I was literally thinking it would be great, like, I could very happily use these to teach children older than the ones I do teach about similes and metaphors.
Yeah. But I don't know if you did this, Willow. I asked if you would write down what you remember about this book before rereading it.
I did.
So yeah, if you could.
Tell us
about that.
What I remembered about the Revenge of the Toffee Monster was that someone breaks into a toffee factory and discovers a monster. Perhaps I was using context clues for this first bit. I believe that the monster was once a human and suffered some sort of grave injustice or accident that led to their toffification, which is, you know, there was elements of correctness in there, but also elements in which I misremembered. I thought it emerged, and I thought that maybe it absorbs people a bit like the blob.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, I wasn't sure. I mean, and then I was thinking that I remember finding the character sympathetic, but I wasn't sure if it was sympathetic on the cover, but then more frightening in the book, felt like there might be some tension between like how it looked in the front cover and how I experienced it as a character. And so that was my, those are my recollections.
Yeah, cool. I mean, that's actually more than I was, that's kind of more than I was expecting, because all I remembered was a toffee texture and a disconsolate atmosphere. So you definitely had to.
But Ren, you read a lot more books than I did. You see, this was from a much smaller percentage of your total.
That's true. Although I think that speaks to how Ren's memory works as well.
It's
textural.
I just remember sort of some sort of character beats. I think the cover drew me to this book when I was young.
Yeah. We should probably describe the covers.
The covers are really warty.
Mm-hmm. Really warty, both of them.
By Tony Blundell.
Mm-hmm.
In both cases.
The Revenge of the Toffee Monster has a very warty toffee monster with a grimace.
Definitely a grimace. I think it looks pained to me.
Yeah. And the sort of the title is also written in a blobby toffee kind of font.
It's a little bit movie poster like, I suppose.
Yeah, schlock movie poster. Mm. Very slight difference in the way that the words are printed, as opposed to the rest of the cover. So they're more shiny than the monster, and the words have got some sort of clever publishing trick done to them.
Yeah, we've got the laminate. We've got a bit of the old laminate on it. Mm. And then Killer Mushrooms Ate My Gran has some, again, very warty mushrooms. Red and...
I mean, brain mushrooms.
Very severe looking.
Yeah, surrounding a...
Inquisitorial.
Surrounding the Gran, who's wearing a cycling helmet and cycling gear.
And the mushroom's a laminate, but the Gran is not this time. I also, just as a sort of flight of fancy, I tried to write down what I remembered of Killer Mushrooms Ate My Gran, having never actually read it before. just to see whether it was more or less accurate than what I remembered of the one I had read.
Okay.
Sort of just like trope association, really. But so I imagine there might be a child who lives with their gran who hates mushrooms and never eats them. In fact, they throw them down into a basement after pretending to eat them each night. And I imagine that maybe they would start to hear noises from the basement and see strange orange glowing eyes at the windows. And then they venture down, but they're scared off. But their gran is not so lucky, and the mushrooms eat her. But they hunger for more. Perhaps they control her like a pod person and use her to lure others down to the basement. And then the child has to build a ragtag crew of misfits from school to destroy the mushrooms, and it validates their dislike of mushrooms.
That's really not bad at all. You clearly have a strong grasp of children's horror tropes under your belt. I'm impressed.
Thank you.
I like how surreal you're making this podcast already. Good addition. Revenge of the Toffee Monster. Our main character is Lenny, He's bored during the summer holidays. All his friends are away, so he rides around on his bike and finds a sign to a toffee museum. He investigates, but finds it kind of dusty and dreary, and is a little unnerved by the image of a Victorian child with a mournful expression on an old toffee tin. He's about to leave when he smells the sweet, buttery smell of toffee and follows it into an industrial kitchen where an old woman is throwing toffee by hand in these kind of great looping strands. Lenny is transfixed by this display, but the toffee-throwing woman, who's revealed to be Miss Butterworth, is very hostile to him initially. She says that little boys used to love Butterworth's toffee, but now they only sell it to the old folks' home, and soon they'll be out of business entirely. So Lenny kind of tries to explain the concept of modern sweets to her, using the example of a sparkle bar in his pocket, which is a candy that fizzes blue foam and turns your teeth blue, and also has a theme song. Don't know if anyone wants to try and sing the theme song on page 25.
Sure, yeah, could I get some backing music? I'll give it a go. Just our style. Give
me a
drop a beat.
All right, if you start... Oh, gosh, if you stop drumming, Ren, I'll come back in a sec. Too old for this.
Wow. Cosmic kids eat sparkle bars. Wow. Sparkle bars are ace. They wow the world, the universe. They wow aliens in space.
Oh, thank you, Alan.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a bit more like a spoken word poem than a song, but you know.
No, that was great. I really enjoyed that. So.
Should we?
Thank you.
Do we want to talk about Lenny in the beginning first, or do we want to sort of do a full?
Song? Yeah, no, feel free. If you have things to say about Lenny.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Lenny was an interesting choice of character and quite cool that this character in the story is poor, like is textually like from like a poor household. His family can't afford to go on holidays. You know, he's bored in a sort of industrial area. And I don't know, I feel like that was, you know, it's not a bunch of posh kids in the countryside solving mysteries. This is quite, he's only like explicitly been to the countryside twice on a school trip.
Yeah.
And he's also a person of colour, like he's half Chinese, and that's relevant in the story, but also isn't made a big deal of in most ways, apart from possibly having toffee in his blood, but that's kind of a weird element. But I just think that like having him, I think that as a character, I feel like it was nice to see him represented, and especially for like teenagers today and like young, like older primary age children today, cost of living crisis, a lot of children can't go on holidays and will have similar experiences to this.
He's quite charming. He's quite a little scamp. I liked him as a character.
Yeah, same here. I like that he's got a whole bunch of ideas whizzing around his head, and sometimes he keeps them to himself, as otherwise he just says them. And I think it gets across how higgledy-piggledy things can feel when you're a kid, and that sense of emotional overwhelm. And she captures that kind of voice of child outrage really well.
And I mean, elements of like quite... like almost, you know, obviously a lot of similes and metaphors as well, but there were some bits which were kind of subtle storytelling, like Lenny having sympathy with Clum, who we haven't heard about yet, but getting in lots of trouble. And I just thought that was quite nice. Like, without saying Lenny was a child who got in lots of trouble at school, it just sort of had that moment of emotional connection and left it at that. And I thought, oh, that's quite good. I enjoyed this.
Yeah. I think it's It's very like straightforwardly written. It's not like, you know, like some of the books we read, are kind of much more sort of poetic kind of.
Oh, I see. This is like the opposite end of the spectrum to Moondial in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like, it's easy to read. It's fun. It's like, I think kids would like this book, which is, you know, for all of Moondial's qualities, is not necessarily something I said about it.
That is really true, actually, because I did think my stepson is not going to be bothered with this, whereas actually I think he'd probably quite. I might give it. He'd probably enjoy these two books and find them fun. So.
Mm.
And I suppose that's part of what they're going for. They're going for a schlocky monster movie like genre, rather than trying to be arty and scary.
Yeah, I guess that's the way that they seem more indebted to American genre fiction than they do necessarily like the classics of British children's literature.
Mm.
Which is nice, because I think that's probably where this more, in this book at least, the more industrial environment comes out of in part.
A working class child on a bike rather than a very posh child in a mansion, which is much more sort of classic English literature style.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Lenny has the idea, because he has a lot of ideas. He says his idea that he should be Miss Butterworth's consultant, and he thinks that he might have toffee in his blood because his mum's Chinese and toffee was invented in ancient China, which sadly isn't true.
Thank you for doing your research.
A quick Google suggests that toffee was invented in England or possibly Wales as a result of the plentiful supplies of sugar reaching the UK in the 19th century from slave labour in the Caribbean. I guess that's what puts a more realistic damper on this whole nostalgic Victorian toffee company business. But there we are.
I found a company called White Rabbit Candy who do sort of toffees in China, but they originate in 1943, which I don't think is the sort of the ancient origins of toffee that they were sort of vaguely alluding to.
Yeah. So that's a fabrication, but you know, it's fine, it's enjoyable. Lenny kind of mentions the toffee tin with the mournful kid on it to Miss Butterworth, which he takes the kid to be a girl because they're wearing a frilly dress, but to Lenny's great outrage, Miss Butterworth reveals that it was a boy, young Master Harold, and that small Victorian boys wore dresses before they were allowed to have their first pair of trousers.
He gets some proper gender outrage across this book.
Yeah. And she also tells him that her grandfather, Josiah Butterworth, was an inventor who experimented with frogs and was fascinated by electricity, and who one night made a living creature out of Brazil nut toffee.
Can I just point out, like, I am so disappointed in myself that for all my love of foreshadowing in, like, you know, RPGs that I run and you know, and like genre literature and films that I watch, I did not get the frog references, even though Clum was very explicitly described as like warty and croaking. And I just did not think, oh, right, obviously the frogs that were mentioned at the beginning were relevant.
Well, yeah. Okay.
I mean, the science of this book might constitute a claim of the week. arguably, I think compared to the rigorous, comparatively rigorous mushroom science of Killer Mushrooms Ate My Gran, I think the toffee science, the animate toffee science in this book is somewhat sketchy.
Yeah.
Miss Butterworth also makes the claim, and I quote, "Toffee is a miraculous substance that it has limitless possibilities," which makes me think of that in The Simpsons with the guy, the salesperson with the gummy gummy lips, who claims that they have 100 different uses, and like a comedic replacement for your own lips. And then Homer says, "Go on."
Yeah,
we get the claim of toffee being used to patch up tires, like a puncture in a bike tire, which I guess would work, maybe for a
it's
while.
Like blue tack in its thousands of uses, isn't it?
Like, yeah,
when you stick something to the wall and then you stick something to something else.
I mean, I think most of the uses are going to be based on its stickiness.
Yeah.
I don't know if stickiness is, like, the only useful property in the universe.
I mean, I've got another possible claim of the week.
Oh, my gosh. We haven't done it for a while, so I'm quite glad to have a claim of the week.
Well, we've already had that toffee was created in ancient China. So
yes, we're really... that's true.
This is a book
maybe less sort of objectively verifiable than those.
Oh, okay. Lines.
But this one is the idea that, so there was a famous film stuntman, I think it was Harold, actually, when he was grown up. But just as he was flying midway, a piece of flying toffee struck him in the right eye. And the explanation given was it was probably dropped by a passing crow. I just don't think that's the most likely scenario. I don't know how I think a toffee would end up in the air, but I don't see why a crow would drop it.
I mean, maybe crows take a fancy to toffee and then they're like, it's not all that.
Very much like the children of today.
Yeah, with their sparkle bars.
I can imagine a crow picking up a stray toffee from the ground and then, yeah, deciding it wasn't for them.
Oh, fine. Okay, I retract. I cheerfully retract.
tense times on Still Scared of Sibling Disagreement.
Yeah. So, Miss Butterworth, though, tells Lenny about this living creature made out of Brazil nut toffee and goes into a bit of the lore of this creature, how they want it to be helpful, but its toffee body never set properly, so anything it tried to fetch, it just stuck to. And
she says, as a life form, it was a total disaster, which, you know... Same sometimes. It's
yeah. Millennial mood. And yeah, it becomes known as Clum because it's always been told it's clumsy. And ended up being banished to the Toffee Works with a young Master Harold as its only friend. And then one night, Harold's mother is getting ready for a ball, and Clum tries to fetch her peacock fan, and it sticks to his hand, and then and he tries to.
Oh, can I please read this section?
Yeah, no, please, yeah.
Okay. That day, said Miss Butterworth, in a voice grim as graveyards. The humbug machine was running full pelt. There was a big humbug order to fill. Harold came dashing in. He didn't think. He was only concerned for his friend. Before Clum could reach this vat, Harold threw himself at him to give him a big hug. It was the only time in his short life that creature had ever been hugged. He was so overjoyed, he put his arms round Harold. He lifted him high in the air. Lenny's hand flew up to his mouth. Oh no, I can't believe it. They stuck together, didn't they? They did. And Harold panicked. He shouted, "Set me down!" But Clum didn't understand. Only squeezed him tighter. Clum didn't know his own strength. And poor Harold couldn't breathe. He struggled to get free from the creature's sticky embrace. But he fell. Lenny gnawed at his knuckles. It was too awful to think about. Harold didn't fall into the humbug machine, did he? Is that what you meant when you said he came to a sticky end. He looked fearfully at the great machine towering above them. He imagined those great iron paddles whacking the toffee mixture, spitting it out as humbugs, flicking it into tins. The thought of Harold being turned into humbugs was more than he could bear. Good heavens, said Miss Padua. What gruesome mind you modern children have got, calling out the reader there. No, Harold didn't fall into the machine. He struck his head on one of the paddles as he fell. Clum saw Harold wasn't moving. He cried toffee tears. His poor heart was broken in two.
Tragic stuff.
It's a sad turn of events.
Thank you, Adam. That was so
yes.
Very good reading.
Clum has something of a Lenny in Of Mice and Men about him.
That's true, actually.
Sort of loving, but written as very sort of as quite low cognitive abilities.
Doesn't know his own strength.
Or indeed stickiness.
So, yeah, I think a mob sort of gather. They think Harold's dead and they hunt Clum down and sort of chase him onto an ice-covered river. And Clum, seeing no way out, breaks the ice and slips into the river. I'll just read that bit. He says, "They say," said Miss Butterworth, "that he turned to look back at the screaming mob just once. Then he looked up at the shining moon. He seemed to reach out for it, trying to fetch it. He loved silvery things, remember? Then he gave a last despairing croak and jumped up and down on the ice until it cracked beneath him. He let himself slip into the icy water." So poor Clum.
Justice for Clum.
Slips into the river, and they pull him out downstream, and as a sort of frozen block of toffee, and Miss Butterworth reveals that they dragged him back to the toffee works and broke him into sacks,
as basically happens to the Blob, I think, because. You're making the comparison to the Blob, and I'm pretty sure that the Blob ends up frozen, and that's how the Blob is blobbed.
Well, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, so it might be a kind of deliberate reference.
Yes, Bobby. Yeah.
Yeah, and she goes down to the cellar, to the deep freeze in the cellar, and brings up a brown sack labelled Clum. Josiah Butterworth chipped Clum into convenient pieces with his personal silver toffee hammer. It's important to note.
Hopefully not eating bits as he went. I don't know, making the Simpsons reference. Now I'm thinking of Homer when he eats his delicious lobster and cries as he devours it. Oh, Clum! Yum, yum, yum.
Yeah. that's a tragic tale of Clum. And Lenny feels so that his heart goes out to Clum, but
Miss Butterworth is about halfway through the book almost.
Sorry?
And this is about halfway through the book almost. Like we don't actually have the living toffee monster for quite a long way through. I guess I sort of expected that would be like the second chapter or something. It's very much not.
Yeah. She tells Lenny that like Clum's sort of kind nature kind of changed towards the end of his life because he was being constantly mistreated and he became dangerous, and so it's for the best that he's in pieces in the freezer. Lenny's kind of still thinking about being a toffee consultant and coming up with ideas of how to use Clum to revitalize Butterworth's toffee.
I'm just thinking of his imagined advert, which is great.
Yeah, he's like, kids love being scared. You can... What does he say about that?
Well, he basically says you can have Clum, like in this advert, threatening children to eat more toffee.
Oh, yeah, buy Butterworth's toffee or else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he holds up one of the sparkle bars and says that they could tell Clum to fetch all the sparkle bars in the city and eliminate the competition. But then his spiel is interrupted by a bell tolling, and he realizes that he needs to go home, and he's kind of tells Miss Butterworth that he'll be back, but he doesn't really mean it.
And there's a sweet line that all the time he was talking, he didn't have to sort out all those mixed up feelings in his head, which I thought was quite nice.
Oh.
Natural extrovert there, just keep talking, it'll be okay.
Yeah. Correspondent Willow.
Yes, indeed. And now we're getting up to bits of Clum, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, so Miss Butterworth's kind of tired out from all this commotion and goes upstairs for a nap, forgetting that the two pieces of Clum are on the kitchen counter where they start to defrost.
She left the hob on. Very dangerous.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so they're defrosting really fast. Mm. And Lenny, meanwhile, sort of goes home and talks to his mum, and she says that she remembers her grandmother. Or she remembers her mum saying that her mum's grandmother made life-size toffee swans for banquets in China. So he's like, oh, I do have toffee in my blood. But so he decides to go back to the toffee works after all. These bits of Clum have activated, and something in them recognises Lenny's instruction to fetch a sparkle bar. And so they sneak out of the toffee works and rampage across the city, snatching sparkle bars from children's hands.
Yes, they were moving horribly fast, like speeded up loopy caterpillars.
Or you can imagine the stop motion in the film adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you need some kind of Cronenbergian modelling for the actual monster.
Yeah.
Miss Butterworth wakes up and she kind of sees what these toffee slugs have been doing with the sparkle bars, and hauls the rest of the 22 sacks of Clum up from the cellar to defrost, because with her limited knowledge of the late 90s from Lenny, she believes that sparkle bars are Butterworth Toffee's only rivals, and she can wipe them all out with these bits of Clum.
It's quite sweet that she has no knowledge of these sort of multinational conglomerate sweet companies, and that she's
Yeah. So Lenny, on his way back to the toffee works, sees this trail of sparkle bars and follows them back to the toffee works. He realizes that Clum had frog DNA in him, and he'd seen something about how some frogs could stay alive through deep freezing. So, like, Clum must have this frog ability.
Oh, I was just thinking about sparkle bars. Sorry, they're very enchanting. And I was wondering if you remember the crackly chocolate. That I think it was maybe Willy Wonka branded or something.
Yeah, right? Yeah, with popping candy.
Oh, yeah.
God, that was great, wasn't it?
That was one of these, like, very, very 90s chocolates, wasn't it?
It was. I feel like that might have been what this was sort of, you know, referencing. It wasn't blue.
Mm.
This one makes people's mouths blue, but that one was very crackly and satisfying.
Hmm.
But only 90s kids will get that reference. So I'm sorry. If you're not a 90s kid, then...
Younger listeners are busy, meanwhile, drinking their energy drinks sponsored by YouTubers. Well, washing down the Tide Pods with the energy drinks.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what gives you the real buzz.
I saw one of those in the newsagent.
What are these YouTuber energy drinks? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was like £9. It was like £9 for life.
I
was like, what?
I let George spend his own pocket money on one, and like he doesn't even he said it was just, you know, it was the talk of the playground. He was like, oh, the other boys, you know, they said it's really good. I was like, oh yeah, really?
Hang on. Are we Mrs. Butterworth now?
Yeah.
You either die a hero, or you live long enough to, or a Harold maybe, or you live long enough to see yourself become Mrs. Butterworth.
Oh, I just mentioned briefly, actually, Willow, because it's been, at least 10, over a decade. So just, for listeners, I still have Willow's copy of The Orange Box, which is a Half-Life 2. Kids, it could have Half-Life 2 Portal and Team Fortress 2. I will say, Willow, I can't even play it. So George, my stepson, wanted to play it. And I was like, oh yeah, I still got this. And I tried loading it up for the first time after having borrowed it like 13 years ago or something. And you must have already registered it with Steam, because it said, oh, this product's already registered, you can't use it. So I borrowed it for all these years for nothing.
Oh dear. Wow. Wow. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sorry, very large tangent there. Apologies.
Oh, while we're tangenting, I should say that I have just got Bert the Coconut Head puppet back in my
possession. Gosh!
Yeah.
Really? Is Bert still all right?
Yeah, Bert's still doing great. Yeah. At least he had him for several years, but now he's back with me. So this is a puppet that Adam made for me with a coconut head some years ago, wearing a little floral dress.
very good.
Very, very good. maybe I'll get Bert to join us for Texture of the Week, actually.
Oh, that might be good. I like that.
Yeah.
Bert can sing Texture of the Week. Good stuff.
Should we do that now?
Oh, yeah. Do we want to? Yeah.
Okay. I'll get Bert.
Okay, I haven't really got clacking coconut mouths. I've got a sort of a metal cup, but I don't know if I can get much of a sound out of it.
Right.
Okay.
Maybe if I.
Yeah, this is Bert's clackety mouth.
Okay, can Bert sing it too?
Okay. Oh god, I haven't done the Bert voice in so long.
Texture of the week. Now that's showbiz.
Showbiz.
Okay, so what's your texture of the week? Is it toffee?
I mean, it's kind of just clum, isn't it? but I did narrow it down a bit to well, we haven't quite got to it yet, but clum ends up covered in sparkle bars as a kind of armor. All of the parts of when he reconstitute all the parts of him sort of fetch the sparkle bars back and he's sort of plated in these silvery wrappered chocolates or sweets. So I think that's quite an arresting image.
It's quite majestic.
Yeah.
I went for a slightly more horrific option. It looked like a writhing mountain of maggots, but they weren't maggots. They were toffee slugs, and they were jiggling about in a frenzy.
mine is actually from Killer Mushrooms Ate My Gran, which, since we're only going to sort of discuss it briefly, I will read this section, because some great mushroom textures here. So the protagonist of this, who's actually called Maggot, has come across a sort of shed full of mushrooms. It says, he'd never seen anything like it. He didn't know fungi this weird existed. They were sneaking over the edge of the mushroom beds, pushing up through the floor, hanging anywhere they could get a grip. They'd taken over the shed and driven out the button mushrooms. There wasn't a boring button mushroom in sight. These fungi were all shapes, all sizes, from tiny toadstools to great big puffballs. They were all colours, from sickly yellow to poisonous blue. Those toadstools were black and rubbery like licorice. That strange purple fungus was like a honeycomb. There was even an orange, frilly fungus creeping along the shed roof. Fungus like dead grey fingers. Fungus flowing like white lava down the shed walls. Some were like soft jelly eggs. Some were warty. Some slimy. A crusty fungus glowing on wood gave off an eerie green glow. And actually, Ren, I'll just mention that our old friend Helen has really got the mushroom fever, and last time I saw her had taken not just photos of lots of different kinds of mushrooms with all sorts of fungal textures, but also videos of her prodding and flicking mushrooms to better enjoy their texture.
Excellent.
that was some beautiful mushroom description right there, though. That was great.
Yeah,
that was great. Yeah. I do want us to talk about killer mushrooms ate my grandma, because it's good mushrooms. It gives good mushrooms.
I think the plotting of Revenge of the Toffee Monster is stronger, but the mushroom vibes are obviously very strong in Killer Mushrooms. But we'll finish Revenge of the Toffee Monster and then we'll talk a bit about Killer Mushrooms.
Miss Butterworth reveals that, as well as the frog DNA, her grandfather chucked a sea sponge into the clum mixture, which means that that the bits of clum can reform into a whole clum. And they do. And reformed clum is not very happy. Lenny has to pretend to be young Master Harold and put on the lacy frock and tam o' shanter, much to his disgust. He leads Clum downstairs, sort of intending to sort of lead him back into the deep freezer, but when they pass the kitchen, bits of Clum dash off and pick up the sparkle bars and clothe him in them. Lenny shows Clum his reflection. Unlike just before his disastrous end, Harold's mother showed Clum his reflection and told him he was a horrible monster. But this time he looks at his reflection and sees that he's a majestical creature.
And he can touch things now. He's no longer a sticky mess.
Miss Butterworth's like hissing at Lenny to lead Clum into the deep freezer, but he doesn't have the heart to do it. So sort of still dressed as Harold, he leads Clum outside, not really knowing where he's taking him. But as they pass a landfill site, a sparkle bar wrapper flutters by, and Clum chases after it and Lenny chases after him. But then Clum sort of catches it at the edge of a vast pit of rubbish and falls in. Just before some JCBs cover the pit with soil and rocks, so burying Clum underneath. Lenny goes back to Toffee Works pretty distraught, but Miss Butterworth is sort of just praises him for saving her business. But Lenny doesn't want anything more to do with Toffee. At the end of the book, he's a little while later, he bumps into Miss Butterworth. Well, he passes the Toffee Works and sees that it's gone, and he's kind of a bit alarmed. But he bumps into Miss Butterworth, and she says that they've moved the whole Toffee Works to the Victorian Street at the Heritage Museum. Sort of in the epilogue, Lenny has become Miss Butterworth's toffee assistant.
So basically, they've moved to York.
Yeah, they're at Beamish. I was about to swear with how much I love those Victorian, like those Victorian street, like mock-up streets.
Oh yeah.
They're so good.
Do you prefer them with mannequins or out of work actors?
Either. I'm not fussy. Okay, I just love walking down a mock-up Victorian street in a museum. I just think they're great. But the ones that have like people actually doing things in them are pretty cool. So this one sounds really good. Like that you can go to an actual sweet shop and see people making toffee. That's ideal, I think.
I have really intense sense memories of like fake Saxon villages that we were perhaps taken to at some point. And like
this. We went to a Gaulish village in France once.
A Gaulish? Yeah. What do you mean a Gaulish village?
Like asterisk, isn't it?
Gaulish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I've got horror on the brain.
The scent of the bread they made there is a very strong sense memory.
They were baking some bread and making some like apple juice and it's all like kind of smoky smells and
dipping some candles and firing.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I love that stuff.
That's great.
Lenny works up the courage to tell her about his Granny Wang and her toffee swans. And she says that she's heard of the famous Wang toffee makers and that she used to make swans too. And then sort of right at the end, we kind of get this horror movie, silver gauntleted toffee hand kind of rising from the ground. So, you know, Clum will be back again.
Yeah, I do like that. Has that movie like ending. Sorry.
Yeah. A little shop of horrors. Well, yeah, depending on which ending.
You sort of had to have the ending in it, but I say because Clum was such a sympathetic character, I didn't feel the sort of sense of like, oh no, it didn't have an oh no feeling. I was like, oh dear, that's going to be really difficult for Lenny.
Much nicer, like it's very different to Goosebumps. Like when I was, reading It Came From Beneath the Sink or Monster Blood, you were never like, oh, Monster Blood, oh, I hope you make a friend.
Clum's a very sympathetic monster.
Humans are trash. In Victorian times, as today, and I think he is correct in his his appraisal of our species.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that he was made of Brazil nut toffee, and that's why he's so lumpy bumpy.
There's a lot of warty, lumpy descriptions in there for Clum. He's a whole mass of textures.
Yeah. And then we come to Killer Mushrooms Ate My Gran, which is from the year 2000. Did either of you notice the most year 2000 reference in this book?
Oh gosh, I don't think so. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. There's a bit where Maggot's thinking about the possibility of the mushrooms taking over the Earth, and he sort of has this vision of them. And he says, they're massive. What, some of them are as big as the Millennium Dome.
Oh.
Instantly carbon dating this book.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. And you tell the kids today that, they'll be like, what's that?
I'd say it's the place I went and watched a really substandard Blackadder episode. That's what it was.
Oh yeah, that was disappointing, wasn't it? I think I found it very cool at the time, but it wasn't great in retrospect.
I listened to a Trash Future episode recently where they were talking about the Millennium Dome, and they kept talking about a giant boy, and like I'd forgotten about the giant boy, but he was.
What was it that? Was that the organs? Because
I remember giant organs. In the body bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there was also, like, you know that sculptor, like, Ron Muick? Ron, who does, like, big sort of quite, like, realistic sculptures of people.
Okay.
He made a giant, mostly naked boy for the Millennium Dome. Yeah.
I misremembered this. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Remember the bleak spectacle of a sort of laminate tunnel of money or something. It was like, yeah, like £1 million that you can look at or something.
Yeah, that sounds likely. I completely misremembered the scale of it. So when people used to say they were going to the O2 Arena, or now saying they're going to the O2 Arena, and I was like, oh, the Millennium Dome. So is that one big room then inside the dome? And it turns out, no, it's basically like a Westfield in there, and part of it is a bowling alley, and part of it is a place you can do gigs, because it's a lot bigger than I thought. Yeah. Oh, right, neither of you have been there either. Great.
No.
Yeah, it's not just one
bad memories, you know, I can't go back. You can't go dome again.
No. I was wondering if the most year 2000 thing would be the slightly unfortunate colonialism, because we're really into sort of British culture hitting our we should have known better into the pop culture stuff around this time. I mean, Little Britain was just around the corner when this book came out, and I don't know, the fact that it just refers to African tribes people without any degree of specificity beyond that is not great.
Yeah, it's fast and loose.
It's very broad. I don't want to read just the beginning of this book, because I think it's got a pretty strong opening. Yeah, this is chapter one. When Maggot arrived at Gran's house, she was trying to read a mushroom.
Sorry, this is a strong opening line.
It is. She'd taken it out of a blue plastic box full of other button mushrooms. Gran squinted at the mushroom. What's it say? I can't see it without my specs. Maggot peered at the top of the mushroom. It had two words carved into it. He read them out loud. Save me. Gran was already rummaging in the box. There's something written on this one, too. She ran into the other room and came back with her reading glasses. This one says, help me, said Gran in a puzzled voice. She handed it to Maggot. There's a face on it, said Maggot. Above the words help me, someone had carved a tragic little face. It was like a sad clown. It had a turned down mouth and tears squirting from the eyes. I mean, I was pretty quite taken with that opening.
And this book does start with a sort of mystery format. There is a sort of a person with a very convincing reason why they're not there, who then it kind of gradually transpires that they are not there for more dark reasons. They have to sort of investigate that.
Yeah, so this is Maggot's grand gentleman friend, Jack Dash, who stood her up at a wedding, and she sort of just kind of feeling kind of sad about that. But Maggot sort of realizes that something more sinister has happened to Jack than that he just stood up his gran. And Jack Dash is a daredevil botanist, as we learn, with a passion for mushrooms. And in his old age was running an ordinary button mushroom farm, but actually, as we heard in Adam's Texture of the Week earlier, there was a lot more going on at the mushroom farm than just button mushrooms. And then this book have you been watching The Last of Us?
No, I haven't. I've heard people have said, oh, it's the first good video game to TV or film adaptation, but obviously they haven't seen the Super Mario Brothers original film, so I haven't been taking that claim very seriously. But yeah, I've heard it's good.
Well, I only saw one episode of it, but it's the concept is of a pandemic caused, a fungal pandemic of sort of inspired by these kind of cordyceps mushrooms that take over their host, which in the case of the real cordyceps fungus is carpenter ants, which yes, I think was in a David Attenborough documentary a while ago, so kind of got quite well known from that. But for anyone who doesn't know, I have bookmarked the description of them in Merlin Sheldrake's book Entangled Life. says, the most prolific and inventive manipulators of animal behavior are a group of fungi that live within the bodies of insects. These zombie fungi are able to modify their host's behavior in ways that brings a clear benefit. By hijacking an insect, the fungus is able to disperse its spores and complete its life cycle. One of the best studied cases is that of the fungus Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, which organizes its life around carpenter ants. Once infected by the fungus, ants are stripped of their instinctive fear of heights, leave the relative safety of their nests, and climb up the nearest plant, a syndrome known as summit disease. In due course, the fungus forces the ant to clamp its jaws around the plant in a death grip. Mycelium grows from the ant's feet and stitches them to the plant's surface. The fungus then digests the ant's body and sprouts a stalk out of its head, from which spores shower down on ants passing by. If the spores miss their targets, they produce secondary sticky spores, which extend outwards on threads that act like tripwires. So, yeah, that's a cordyceps.
What I found most disturbing from Sheldrake's book is the fact that the mushrooms don't actually, you know, you sort of assume, okay, they must have just grown inside the ant's brain or something, but they actually replace the whole ant's nervous system.
Yeah.
So it's like they're being puppeteered. The nervous system has been replaced by this network of mycelium.
Yeah.
So it's like the nervous system is being puppeteered, or is the mushroom. Which, yeah, is a really freaky idea.
Yeah.
And is this replicated in The Last of Us, Ren? Is it spore-based transaction? Or like infection? Or is it more bitey?
Do they climb up high and like get stitched to things?
I honestly don't know, because I only saw one episode, and by that point they'd got more to the point of the humans are the real threat rather than the
God, they get quick to that point these days. It used to be nearly the end of a Romero film you'd find that out.
Yeah. No, it was already the real threat was Melanie Lynskey by the time I saw an episode.
I think it's biting. I mean, I haven't seen it, but so I don't want to insult it. But like, I feel like they should have climbed up higher. And
it would be better if they climbed lampposts and then like showered spores down on
that. Would be
yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if Junji Ito gets brought in to do some animated version, I guess that's what will happen. But yeah, until then.
So yeah, this book does actually go pretty hard on the horror of people being not so much eaten by mushrooms as taken over by mushrooms.
Killer mushrooms metaphorically ate my gran.
Yes, it's true. They don't eat her at all. They, if anything, are persuasively convert her to the cause of communism.
That's true.
So the reason why communism is because the book has some I think some obvious inspiration from The Body Snatchers, from Jack Finney, 1955, which was very much a Red Scare kind of schlock book about people being taken over and sort of and the sort of I believe this is why the understood to be a reference to communism and sort of the idea that the American individualism would be robbed by this sort of group control and think. And so to really labour that metaphor, Gran just becomes a communist by the end of it.
And actually, it does make being a mushroom sound pretty great. Like, so when she has been fungicized, what's the word they used? Fungized, something like that. She has kind of utopic visions of a mushroom colonized future, with no cars and no pollution and just mushrooms dotting the landscape. It sounds lovely, to be honest.
I think, can I sign you both up for the, I've got some literature here about it, you might find it interesting, just read it in your own time.
I mean, you know, it's worth considering, I think. I'm not going to discount the option of becoming a fungus person at this point. They kind of go to the mushroom farm and find Jack, and he's all mushroomified.
That's pretty wonderfully described, actually. I've got this bit, but we don't know who it is first. It says the thing. It says The thing had scuttled into a corner. Now for the first time, he had a good look at it. It crouched there, slyly watching him. His eyes glittered from under the brim of a strange tall hat. Which makes him sound like the Babadook, actually. It was thin and spindly, like a seedling grown in the dark. Its lips were like chalk. You could see its skin, as white and waxy as church candles, through its tattered clothes. Along with the top hat, the thing wore a tailcoat and trousers. The whole outfit was speckled with rust and mildew. It seemed to be mouldering away. You could see it had once been a really posh suit, grey with a tasteful blue stripe.
I think the white and waxy as church candles was also a texture that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I saw some writing advice that's like if you have two similes or metaphors on a page, you should make them fight it out and like only keep the best one. Whereas Susan Gates is taking the entirely opposite approach.
as I do when introducing any scene in a role play game, you just layer them in. Fine, no one's going to reread it. You just got to.
And Gran is turned to the mushroom cause, and so basically Maggot has to work out a way to save his Gran, and possibly Mad Dash Jack as well, but
which he does with the help of his Gran's own
herbal
which,
tea,
which Jack had bought back, right, for her.
Yes, yeah.
Medicinal
tea.
So he manages to defungify his Gran, but it's too late for Jack. He's been mushroomed too long.
And sacrifices himself to save them all. Moment of heroism.
And then the mushrooms sort of seem to be defeated and come back and seem to be defeated and come back.
Yeah. There's several rounds of this.
It's quite interesting. I don't know how old Maggot is meant to be. I don't know if it actually says, but by the end of chapter 9, he has quite a a difficult choice. He chooses to lie to his gran about the remaining sentience in Jack Dash, because Jack sort of says that he's going to sacrifice himself, and Gran asks if Jack said anything, and he sort of has a bit of a sort of Telltale Games moment where he has these two difficult choices, and Gran will remember it. And he chooses to lie to her and say that Jack was not sentient and he had just become full mushroom because his grandma would be too sad to know that there was something of him still in there. Which is quite heavy. Yes. If this is like an 11-year-old child, that's...
he's still in primary school. We know that much.
Yeah. Oh, that's an adverse childhood experience right there. Poor little
yeah.
Yeah,
and Maggot's quite an interesting kid. Yeah. Like, I liked the possible kind of echolalia of like when overwhelmed or feeling awkward, Maggot makes arfing noise like a seal.
Oh yeah.
There's quite a lot of sounds in this as well. There's the batonging and the batinging from the spit bowl, which is quite a significant artifact for the story. And then the mushrooms make a crack noise? Crack sound. Sharp as a whip crack, it is. And that's a sort of their noise as well. It's quite a noisy, noisy book.
Yeah, it made me think of Philip Ridley a little bit with the sounds.
Yeah.
By Vinegar Street.
Yeah, where everyone's got their own little tics and things they say and sound effects and stuff. Yeah.
And it ends on a similar note to Revenge of the Toffee Monster, where then a sequel might be set up.
But I don't think any of these did get sequels. I think that was just sort of a narrative, that you know, a necessary narrative sort of flourish for the genre.
Yeah, I think it is to make them seem more like schlocky 1950s horror sci-fi films.
There's clearly Susan Gates was pretty interested in fungi. And like did you know, research for this book. Because at the end it's talking about hyphae, the snaking sort of arms of mycelial network that stretch underground, you know.
According to Merlin Sheldrake, can somehow sense the end of a maze without actually touching it. That's one of the bits in Sheldrake's book that really freaked me out, the idea that a mycelial network can navigate a maze without actually, like, getting... Like, they can sense somehow when there's a dead end before actually getting to the end of that path. And scientists not know how they do this.
Yeah. So I think Susan Gates was a bit ahead of her time. I mean, I think, you know, with her... this interest in mushrooms because
she was right about sponges, as it turns out. You can put them through a sieve and they'll come back together again. Correctly researched, Susan Gates, congratulations.
Yeah. Oh wow, so maybe I shouldn't have been so dismissive of some of the toffee science.
She also
the Toffee Monster.
She wrote A Brief History of Slime in 2003, and you don't need to be a 90s kid to like slime because the kids of today bang into it.
That's true, actually. You're really? Right. Slime's really come back. They were making slime for Science Week at the school I've been doing my teacher training at. Yeah, just this week.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, slime's cool again.
she wrote so many books. Looking at some of our other ones.
Can we finish off something? Are there any particularly interesting titles that are coming up, Willow?
I mean, I think the sea hag, suckers, and cobra sharks sounds quite interesting. It's one that was before the Revenge of the Toffee Monster. It has a cover which is really quite something. A sort of purplish jellyfish creature with a kind of screaming baby face and a sharp row of fangs. There's also a trousers-based one. I think it's about killer trousers that I actually do remember. And the killer coat. There was a few ones about items of clothing that devoured people, which I remember. I think I may have been one of those as well. Yeah, Return of the Killer Coat, Revenge of the Killer Trousers, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they had, like, the zip became their teeth. That was, Oh, my goodness, there's one called Dr. Fell's Cabinet of Smells.
A texture less often explored in a...
they might be ones to look into in the future.
I found these pretty enjoyable.
Yeah, they're fun. Thank you. Were they your suggestion, Willi?
I think so, yeah. So, Ren, you and I were discussing, like, you know, possibility of me reoccurring, and you asked me what children's horror-y or spooky books I remembered, and I had a sort of a flash of the cover and then was, like, frantically Googling sticky orange creature children's book ? And I managed to find my way over to this, and I was like, oh, yes, that's the one.
Nice.
And I've never before properly noticed that the moon is on the front cover that he reached out towards before slipping into the
moon. Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's great to revisit this. I'm a friend of mine saw it as well, and the front cover had a very strong sort of sense memory for him as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us again, Willow. It's great to have you back.
Yeah, thank you.
Anytime. No, thank you very much for having me on. It's been an enjoyable journey down memory lane.
I mean, as you are actually a primary school teacher, if you come across anything in your line of work, any current children's horror that you want to discuss, then let us know.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I'd have to ask some of my older teaching colleagues, because, I mean, there are some sort of spooky-ish books which are aimed at the sort of the year two kind of age that I teach. I mean, Lemony Snicket's The Dark is a very beautiful picture book, which does explore some spooky themes. But it would probably...
That might be that we haven't done any Lemony Snicket's.
Yeah, and we haven't done a picture book. We'd round up for a
while.
Quite
a while, yeah. We did Not Now Burn It before, didn't we?
Yeah, I remember.
We'll have you back on for a picture book roundup.
That would be wonderful, yeah. I'd love that.
Cool.
Okay, well, thank you. Do you have the credits, Red?
Yeah. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. And details or links to their stuff is in the show notes. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. And like, if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to rate and review us on Apple Music or whatever. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Yeah. Die a Harold, don't be a Butterworth, spooky kids.
Yeah. Well,
also, if you do have toffee in your blood, please go and see your GP. It's actually very serious.
Yeah.
Bye.
Spooky kids.
Bye.